And in a big surprise, we'll hear now the case of In Re United Airlines. Kieselstein.
I drew the short straw at the office today, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor, this matter is on appeal from the District Court opinion holding that the sublease between RAIC and United was a true lease for purposes of Section 365 and reversing the Bankruptcy Court's holding on summary judgment that the sublease was a disguised financing. Your Honor, in the SFO opinion, the Court identified several material facts which demonstrated that the SFO transaction was not a true lease. All of those facts are present in this case. First, as an SFO, the payments denominated as rent bear no relationship to the value of property allegedly leased, but rather are precisely matched to the penny, the amount necessary to service a debt. Now, the same is undisputedly so in LAX as it was in SFO. Second, in SFO, there was a hell or high water clause which required United to pay the purported rent come casualty, condemnation, or Armageddon, notwithstanding, simply because the fact that the money had been loaned, and once loaned, the lender had no further obligations, nor was it inclined to care about the borrower's problems. So if the earthquake this Court discussed in the SFO opinion migrated down the San Andreas Fault to Los Angeles and destroyed the facilities, that next wire transfer would have to be sent by United regardless. Third, Your Honor, in the SFO case, CSCDA had no reversionary interest once the sublease ended, and the same is undisputably so in LAX, although the appellees suggest that RAIC and the City of Los Angeles ought to be treated as one. Now, that's an argument that's been made and flatly rejected in Ryder versus City of San Diego, which was cited in our case. Now, also, as the appellees in SFO attempted, RAIC and the City tried to invert the reversionary interest argument to focus on United's admitted lack of any right to ownership of an airport facility and suggest this undisputed fact is dispositive in their favor. But this argument is no more compelling in LAX than it was at SFO. All the parties acknowledge United will not now, nor will it ever, own property at LAX, barring a change in the law. Again, this is identical in San Francisco and in LAX. Fourth, Your Honor, there was a balloon payment at the end of the lease in San Francisco, which was viewed as a clear indication of a financing. That is also indisputably the case in LAX. A $59 million balloon payment of purported rent is due at maturity or early termination of the facilities lease, whether United occupies the space for a day, a year, or the full term. Again, same as SFO. Fifth, in SFO, United subleased a 20-acre parcel to CSCDA for a dollar and subleased the same 20 acres for several hundred million dollars in total payment streams over the expected life of the sublease, including the balloon payment. A transfer for nominal consideration by United and a simultaneous transfer of the same property to United for an enormous sum of money. The same is indisputably so in LAX. Except in LAX, United doesn't even get the $1 for the partial assignment of its rights under the true terminal lease with the City of Los Angeles. It gets nothing. And, of course, under the sublease, it is obligated to pay hundreds of millions of dollars of total payment stream. Same as SFO. Fifth, in SFO, the sublease and sub-sublease drop away when the bonds are paid off at maturity or earlier, leaving United with full reversionary rights as tenant under its true lease with the City of San Francisco. The same is undisputably true in LAX. The sublease between United and Rake terminates immediately, and the rental obligation ceases once interest, premium, and principal are paid in full, whenever that should happen to occur. Now, confronted with its doppelganger in SFO, the appellees strive mightily in a futile effort to create some distance. First, appellees attempt to distinguish SFO by contending that Rake's costs, like those of the City of Los Angeles, are the equivalent of market value, and try to create a cost recovery test, which is admittedly how the City of Los Angeles and most true landlords under airport leases recover their costs and get paid under leases. The city and Rake suggest here that the facility's rent is nothing more than a manifestation of the cost recovery method applied to RAIC. And again, this is true for the terminal lease, but that methodology is absolutely not the case with Rake. Section 4B of the sublease provides that in addition to the facility rent, the airline shall pay such amounts of additional rent as shall be required to pay all expenses of the corporation, that is Rake. That provision requires United to fund an account, the corporate operations account. The amount to be funded is $2,500. Although admittedly, there's a continuing obligation for United to top off the account should the balance drop below $2,500. Clearly, then, the millions of dollars that United paid each year and the balloon at the end of the term has nothing whatsoever to do with the recovery of the nominal administrative costs of Rake in administering this loan. The other fact that LA seems to hang its hat on is that United used the bond proceeds to construct improvements on the same piece of land as is covered by the sublease. In San Francisco, those were not the facts. In San Francisco, the 20 acres that were leased back to United under the sublease were not the location where the bond proceeds were used to construct the facility. But that's a meaningless distinction. First, wherever the improvements were located, wherever the facilities were built, the facility's rental for the LAX sublease still bore and bear no resemblance to the market value of those facilities. It's still just payments for hired capital, and it doesn't matter if the new facility was built on the property covered by the sublease or not on the property covered by the sublease. Now, LA and Rake tried to persuade the court that there was some new asset given back under the sublease that United didn't have when it did the partial assignment to Rake. Of course, those things happened on the same day. And to hear appellees tell it, United assigned an unimproved plot of ground in the morning of November 15, 1982, and received back a sparkling new facility that afternoon. Now, the obvious flaw in this argument is that United was fully on the hook for the full $59 million that was covered by the facility's rent before the first shovel of earth was turned. And California law, to touch on that for a moment, as we know, follows a functional approach. And we cited some cases, and the court in its SFO opinion cited cases, which the LA and Rake try to distinguish themselves from. For instance, the Burr case, there's an attempt to distinguish by suggesting that the tenant obtained the right to use new property it didn't own before. But of course here, United already owned the property in question before the partial assignment of the sublease. It did not obtain the improved terminal facility from Rake. All it received from Rake was the money. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. McLaughlin.
May it please the court. Patrick McLaughlin for the appellees, U.S. Bank as trustee, the City of Los Angeles, and RAIC. Your Honors, I need to begin by correcting a significant misstatement of the record and the facts. It is not the case that at the end of the sublease term, United has any right or interest in the improved facilities. Pursuant to the sublease, Section 3, and the terminal lease, Section 5, United Appendix 00049, when the bonds are paid, both the terminal lease and the sublease terminate, and United's right to possess the improved facilities terminates with it. So that makes our structure more like Denver and less like San Francisco in that regard. Now, that wasn't the case in San Francisco, and the reason it wasn't was because what United did in San Francisco was to take a maintenance-based facility that it already had an interest in, assign it to San Francisco, and lease it back. There at the end of the facility...
Excuse me. If I recall the San Francisco transaction, the sublease exceeded the term of the lease, so that United was actually going to lose its rights under the lease before it had finished paying for the improvements on the sublease.
The sublease was only...
strange features of the transaction.
The sublease was only for a portion of the maintenance-based lease. But it
You're not grappling with the fact. United's lease with the airport, which it had then used the sublease as security, expired before the bonds were going to be paid. So, on your perspective, by the time the bonds had been paid, United would have lost all of its rights to the facilities and, indeed, to the maintenance base. So if that were dispositive, the San Francisco case would have come out the other way.
But there's no connection between United's payment of the on the maintenance base lease and its use of the improved facilities, because the improved facilities weren't the subject of the lease. The final paragraph of this court's analysis of the recharacterization claims in San Francisco recognizes that a lease can be part of a financing if it is a vehicle for the acquisition of an asset. Well, the lease was not a vehicle for an acquisition of an asset in SFO. It was a pledge of an asset United already had, its leasehold interest in the maintenance base. The bonds in San Francisco improved the terminal facility, not the maintenance base that was the subject of the sublease leaseback situation. Here, the facilities lease is used as a vehicle to acquire a new asset, an improved airport terminal facility. And in that way, it is indistinguishable from the transactions A and B in Burr that Burr found to be true leases. I think Burr controls the court's determination of this. Burr's critical factor is whether or not the lease is used to acquire a new asset. In Burr, the true lease was used to acquire pool tables that Burr wanted to use as he expanded his operation. Here, the true lease is being used by United to acquire an improved terminal facility that it's going to use to conduct its business. And the rental payments are continuing inputs in connection with that acquisition. If the parties needed to make the fact that this is a lease still more clear, they did so by declaring that when United's rights to possess this improved terminal that it's paying for with its lease payments expires, 20% of the value of the improved facility remains behind. This is really a kind of a mirror image of the Uniform Commercial Code, which is the law in California, 120136, defines a disguised financing as a lease in which the term is coterminous with the useful value of the asset. That's a badge of a financing. What the parties here did by saying we're leaving 20% behind was to say we're not that. We're a true lease. So the fact that this is being used to acquire an asset, and the fact that United can never own the asset, and Your Honor, we're not talking about title here. We're talking about an economic definition of ownership. Ownership in the sense of the ability to unilaterally enjoy the entire value of the thing in use. Well, United does not have that here. In fact, it must give it up when 20% of the value still remains. That is the way that the parties expressed their intent, that what was going on here was the ongoing acquisition of new inputs post-petition after bankruptcy, where the rental payments paid for the use of an asset that United was needed for the conduct of its business as a tenant in a terminal in LAX. Finally, the Frank Lyons case, I think, is instructive, too. What we're talking about here is what sophisticated parties entered into, and I think Frank Lyons says that if they chose a lease form, and I think by the 20% residual they express that intent, that should be honored. And I think when these sophisticated parties chose this form, it was the driver for the fact that the borrower here could borrow on a tax-exempt basis. But the borrower was the landlord, RAIC. Just like in Burr, the borrower was the landlord of that pool table. That landlord went out and borrowed money to acquire the pool table, and Burr's true rent on his true lease was measured by that borrower's financing costs, just like United's true rent in this true lease is measured by RAIC's financing cost and its borrowing. United was never the borrower in this transaction. RAIC was the borrower, and it was the borrower for the benefit of the city of Los Angeles. I have nothing more, Your Honor, unless you have any questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further?
30 seconds.
Your Honor, I think the point that counsel kept hammering on, which is that United is paying for the use of the of an asset, the fact is the minute United borrowed this money, it was liable to repay on the schedule that was laid out. Had United never built this facility, it would have been liable to repay just the same. There's no continuing consumption with respect to a building that didn't exist when the capital was hired. As far as the 20% lease residual, I think that's a tax-driven test that we find across all of these transactions. It's no more meaningful in L.A. than it is in San Francisco. With respect to when the leases expire, I think the relevant provision of Section 5 suggests that if there's a financing that's less than the remaining term of the lease, then the lease shall expire coincident with the expiration of said financing. In fact, there have been a number of redemptions of bonds since the original bonds were placed in 1982 when this was entered into without any interruption of United's rights under the terminal lease. That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.